If you've been to Yellowstone National Park in recent years, you may have heard this. Those are gray wolves, specifically the wolves of the Druid Peak Pack. The Druids, as they're called, were the dominant pack in Yellowstone's Lamar Valley for more than a decade. Because their den was close to a main road, they became the most closely watched wolves in the park, and perhaps in the world. Researchers studied them day after day, gaining new information about wolf behavior. Last summer, there were 18 wolves in the pack, but since then, they've been decimated by disease and by competition from other wolves. Yellowstone biologist Doug Smith says the Druids are now down to just one wolf, and she's not doing well.
She's very, very thin. She's missing hair on about half of her body. She's moved out of Lamar Valley, so she's on the fringe now, and I just don't think she's going to make it.
What do you do in a situation like that? Do you leave her to the wild, or do you try to take her in and attempt to nurse her back to health?
Well, that's a great question, and it deals with the heart of what national parks are all about. We let nature take its course. This decline of the Druid pack and the state of this last female is all part of the natural scheme of things. So we allow nature to take its course.
I'd like to know a little bit more about the pack. What made them so special, and what it was that visitors to Yellowstone were able to see?
Well, most importantly, they were easy to see. I mean, if you came to Yellowstone during the Druid pack rain and spent a day or two looking, you'd see them. They had two leaders of the pack. We call them alphas. The male's number was 21. The female's is 42. They were a classic couple. People love to anthropomorphize about them. Geez, look how much they love each other, how they care for each other, how good mom and dad they are. I would go out some days and there would be 300 or 400 people on the roadside just lapping this up. You know, real nature we don't get anymore, and they provided it.
Filmmakers working in the park captured something pretty extraordinary back in 2003, this ritual as a new breeding male was welcomed into the pack. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the alpha male in Druid had been shot outside the park. This roaming male senses that there's a vacancy, but if you make a mistake, you're dead. So there was this sequence. It went on all day. A filmmaker was there. Part of my team was there. That they observed this kind of touch-and-go joining of the pack by an outside male, and that was 21, who went on to be that famous alpha wolf. He was hesitating and howling, and wolves from Druid would come out, typically the young females, and they were coming out and what we called play bowing for this male, and he was stiff and rigid, tail in the air, nervous, and he felt his way through it masterfully.
What other packs are you watching right now? Is there another pack that will replace the Druids?
There is. It's going to be, I think, another crowd favorite. The alpha female is lightly colored, and the nickname, the Silver Pack, came from her. They have slipped right in where the Druids used to be, and in fact, they killed a couple of the Druids. There's a new pack, we call them the Trio, two males and a female, at the far west end of the old Druid territory. They will likely have pups this year and be another pack. And then another pack at the far west end of Wolf Range called the Blacktail Pack is another pack that's being closely watched.
Doug Smith, thank you very much.
You bet.
Doug Smith is a wolf biologist and the leader of the Yellowstone Wolf Project.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Joining me to talk about Toyota's troubles and why it's so hard to pinpoint exactly what's causing the acceleration problems is Ken Bensinger. He's a business reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Ken, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
Yesterday, Toyota was steadfast that sudden acceleration is a mechanical, not an electrical problem. How has Toyota been able to determine that?
Well, Toyota has pinpointed two things. They say that floor mats can trap down the accelerator pedal. Separately, on some models, that there's a pedal that can stick in a depressed or partially depressed position. And I don't think anyone argues that there is some truth to that. But They themselves have admitted it doesn't explain all cases. And Congress said something to the effect that it doesn't explain about 70% of the cases. In response, Toyota has said they've done thorough electronic testing of different electrical systems and that they have found no evidence whatsoever that there is any fault that could cause sudden acceleration. That said, there's a lot of skeptics out there. There's a lot of independent scientists and others who question those and say that Toyota hasn't been sufficiently thorough in the testing of the electronic systems, which today can make up about 40% of the value of a car.
So you noted these independent engineers. In at least one case, they were able to show how creating an induced electronic short could cause the vehicle to suddenly accelerate and almost race out of control. How do you put that in context with what Toyota is claiming, that this is not in any way an electrical problem?
Well, it's a very controversial study you're referring to. It's a gentleman at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, who did produce a short that did do exactly what you suggested. Toyota attacked that yesterday, saying that it was an unrealistic situation and it couldn't be repeated in the real world. Some would say that what they did didn't really get at what the scientist was talking about, which what he was talking about was the idea that there could be a whole world of problems that Toyota hasn't addressed and that Toyota is turning a blind eye to those and only addressing in a very specific, literal fashion the particular faults that are brought forward. The trick with electronic systems is they're extraordinarily complex to analyze and require huge amounts of time and patience to get to the bottom of. And some people are questioning whether Toyota really did everything it could do in that regard or continues to do everything it can.
Ken Bensinger, help me understand something. A lot of these newer cars have very sophisticated diagnostic systems. So whether this was mechanical or electrical, why is there no evidence somewhere in the internal reporting system in the car that would help Toyota figure out exactly what's at fault here?
That's exactly the argument Toyota has made, that they don't see what are known as error codes or engine codes coming up. That's the red light in your dashboard that pops up when it says check engine when there's something wrong. And they said in the absence of those, there can't be a problem. But software engineers will tell you that there are problems that don't set off codes. There are bugs in the system that are rare and non-repeatable that don't leave a mark, so to speak, electronically. And there are kinds of shorts and other things that also wouldn't. And that really gets to the heart of what this Southern Illinois University professor was getting at, which is he was able to produce an error situation without actually getting a code. That's something that's not just limited to cars. We've seen that in aerospace. We've seen that with some horrific plane crashes and other accidents where there's no direct electronic evidence, and it takes months, if not years, of research to find the problem.
Would the resolution to this problem be radically different if it turned out that it was electrical instead of mechanical?
I think so. This is something we looked at here at the Los Angeles Times, why Toyota seems so resistant to electronic issue. And the answer is because it's a much bigger kind of problem than a mechanical problem. Fixing electronic problem is more complex. It also is a little bit more scary in the public eye. When people think about a sticking pedal, they think, fine, swap out my pedal and I'll be okay, or add a little piece to it. When you think about a computer problem, you start thinking about your desktop that crashes all the time, and that gets very scary when you're talking about vehicles that weigh 4,000 pounds and go 75 miles an hour. People are terrified of that and don't want to think about that. The other issue is litigation. The legal risk is very high because once you start saying there's a potential software or other electronic bug, everyone and their brother will start blaming every fender bender on that, whether it's true or not. And certainly a lot of potentially spurious litigation could ensue that even if Toyota wins, could have it tied up in courts for years.
Ken Bensinger, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for the time.
Ken Bensinger is a business reporter for the Los Angeles Times.
This is NPR.
This next story was a bit surprising to us because we've been hearing so many stories about school systems trying to find ways to give students more time on task in the classroom. However, a small but growing number of school districts are bucking that trend and moving to a four-day week, mainly to save money. About 100 schools in 17 states use a four-day model, and many more are reportedly looking at an abbreviated work week. Mike Griffith is the senior school finance analyst for the Education Commission of the States, and he's compiled data about this emerging trend, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Mr. Griffith, how does this work? If the students are in school only 4 days a week, are those 4 days much longer?
They are longer, but I wouldn't say much longer. They're about an hour more a day, about an hour and 10 minutes in most cases, over the traditional school day.
And are we talking mainly elementary schools?
It's a mix of elementary schools and high schools. We have seen some districts change all their schools over to the four-day week. And in other cases, we've seen individual schools within districts change to the four-day week.
I understand school districts are doing this primarily because of budget concerns. Do they really save that much money by shaving one day off the week?
The only districts that save a lot of money from moving to this are those districts that have an awful lot of busing required and high transportation cost. So it's those school districts that have a small amount of students and a large geographical area. So it tends to be rural districts that mostly pick up on this program.
Does this in the end, though, make it more difficult to improve student performance? It seems to fly in the face of several reports and directives and an awful lot of reporting that suggests that students actually do better if they spend more time in the classroom, not less.
There's an awful lot of debate about it, and we've seen the trend. In the past, there were school districts that had a four-day school week. They tended to be in places that it was difficult to transport students. But as time has moved on, we've seen more districts looking at this because of cost savings. But the jury's still out if there's a great impact on student learning one way or the other. There's an awful lot of feeling out there, although not a lot of statistics right now, that moving to this could actually hurt student learning.
And yet more and more schools are at least looking into this.
They are, because right now, with the cutbacks in state funding and local funding, they need to find ways to balance their budget. So they're not left with many options at a certain point. So the things you're looking at are choices that are tough for anyone to make, either larger class size or discontinuation of programs like arts and science and music, or moving to something like this. Now, one of the issues around it is, at first you think you can save a great deal of money, but as you look at it as a school or school district, the amount you save really is not that high. You're talking maybe saving 5% or so from your budget. And so once people start to see that the savings are that low, even though they talk about it and think about it, they tend to back away from the four-day week.
What do the parents think of this?
They're mixed. In some cases, and it really gets down to what is your individual family dynamic. If there is a parent at home, either who works at home or is a stay-at-home parent, then they are much more receptive to it. If, though, both parents are working, it creates some difficulties. And we've seen some pushback from those families where they say, you know, now we have to spend time for daycare or a babysitter. We have to adjust our schedules. In some cases, their bosses are not flexible with their work plans. And it creates some difficulties.
It is interesting, though, since it wasn't that long ago that schools were introducing year-round programs.
Absolutely. And it's sort of a unique thing. Just maybe 2 years ago, we kept hearing over and over of extending the school day, extending the school year, trying to get more weekend programs for those students who are behind, and then to come to this point now where we're talking more and more about reduced time. They've cut everything they can, and now they're looking at what's left that we can cut to save some money.
Mike Griffith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mike Griffith is a senior school finance analyst for the Education Commission of the States. He joined us from Denver.
Some corporations report they do have work for people but can't find people with the right skills. At the same time, some laid-off workers are being trained for jobs that don't exist. Emily McCord of member station WYSO visited a community college in Dayton that's trying to address this mismatch.
Casey Wilson is standing in an expansive white room wearing a lab coat and safety goggles. She's holding a piece of woven fabric. It is glue on one side, and she's sticking it to a big metal bracket. She's learning how to make a composite. If this doesn't feel much like the typical classroom, well, that's because it isn't. It's a college course being held at Vector Composites, a startup research and manufacturing business that makes parts for aerospace and defense systems in Dayton.
All of a sudden, I got to go fill a parking lot full of cars. I don't have people to go hire because they don't exist in Dayton.
Tim Brocklehurst is the manager at Vector Composites. And while he wants to hire new workers, he's struggling to find people who can do the job.
You know, here we are with folks that have high school level educations. I've got a PhD in materials engineering that's teaching this class. We took us like 5 attempts to get this curriculum into something that someone without the exposure can understand. I mean, that's difficult.
Casey Wilson used to work at a local tool and die company before she was laid off. She says this school experience is a completely new one for her.
They could have really taught this way above our heads, and they made a great effort to bring it down. I felt like we actually learned.
Wilson can expect to make about $14 an hour in this field once she completes her training. But let's back up a bit here. This class represents a shift in approach. In 2006, Sinclair Community College officials launched a study that changed the way they thought about job retraining. It found that there were both a lot of unemployed residents here and a lot of jobs going unfilled.
And people would say, well, just have those unemployed get those jobs. How simple, right? Just have them get those jobs. Well, part of the complexity was the skill set didn't match.
Deb Norris is with Workforce Development at Sinclair. The college used stimulus money to create programs for students who want jobs in manufacturing but needed a little help to get those jobs. So Tim Brocklehurst gets his employee trained in composites. Casey Wilson betters her odds of getting a job. Everybody wins, right? Well, Norris says, not everybody.
There is still very high potential earning power. You just have to have a different set of skills.
Not everyone is able to get hands-on training at places like Vector Composites. There are prerequisites, and many students need to take remedial classes before progressing. So getting a job in manufacturing can take almost as much schooling as, say, getting a job in information technology, or in Eddie Miller's case, as a social worker.
We've been so working on using our physical means to do a job, and now we're being thrown into doing a mental part of the job, and it becomes just an incredibly difficult thing to do.
Miller made trucks at General Motors before he was laid off just over a year ago. He has to take some entry-level classes, and he thinks it'll take some time to finish school. While he's fine with that, he worries about his former GM assembly line colleagues.
I don't know what's going to happen to the people. I don't know what's going to happen to me. It's going to take 3 years. Well, most of the people are going to be burnt out by then, or can't afford to go, or they have to worry about their mortgages.
Deb Norris at Sinclair College understands that frustration, but she says the job landscape is just dramatically different now.
The beauty of General Motors for a number of years was that they paid very, very well. And not only was the pay, but the benefits were just outstanding. And that was a beautiful, beautiful thing. But it's not here any longer.
For Eddie Miller and others like him, that's a tough reality. Miller says he has friends who've already given up on school, but he's not going to. Even though it may take a few years, he believes it's his best chance to find and keep a good job again. For NPR News, I'm Emily McCord.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It didn't take long for the recent mortgage crisis to work its way into American art and literature. The new novel Model Home by Eric Puckner uses the collapse of the housing market as a backdrop for the near collapse of a family. Alan Chews has this review.
The Zillers, on the surface, resemble something like a model family when they first move into their new house in an upper-middle-class Southern California subdivision. But they're more like the dysfunctional family in the TV show Arrested Development. We meet the parents, Warren and Camille, the kids, daughter Lyle, older brother Dustin, younger brother Jonas. It doesn't take long for the family finances to fall apart. Dad has been trying to sell some model homes out in the desert, model homes that happen to be within distinct sniffing distance of a large waste pond. And as money becomes scarce, Dad has to move the family into one of these houses and take a job as a door-to-door salesman. The kids suffer these problems as well as their own, such as adolescence, a major injury from a house fire, and the struggle to try and piece their worlds together while the Ziller marriage falls to pieces around them. Puckner's prose is forthright, delightfully detailed, and the distance he strikes from his character seems just right. Not so close that we can't see them in social context, not so far that we don't feel for them deeply in their distress. I came to feel so deeply for them that the book now and then became almost excruciating to read. The feckless parents, the desperate kids struggling to stay alive and in love with a home world crumbling around them. As son Dustin puts it, he misses what he thinks of as the slow, jokey, unrehearsed vaudeville of being a Ziller. I'm still trying to recover from reading about the Zillers, Dustin's family, and maybe my family, and maybe yours, too.
The new novel, Model Home, was written by Eric Puckner. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're looking more closely this morning at an obstacle to passing a health care bill. The obstacle is abortion. Lawmakers say they want to keep from changing the rules against federal funding for abortions, but they don't agree how to do that. We heard about this last week from our health policy correspondent, Julie Rovner, who's with us once again. Hi, Julie.
Good morning, Steve.
And this story underlines the dilemma of a particular group of religious leaders, Catholic bishops. So we'll talk about that with Father Thomas Rees, who directs the Religion and Public Policy Program at Georgetown University's Woodstock Theological Center. He's in our studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
What are the bishops so concerned about here?
Well, the bishops are concerned that there be no money in the health care bill that goes to insurance plans or programs that have abortion as part of those programs.
And let's remember, there's already in force what's called the Hyde Amendment, which basically says no federal funding for abortions. And the concern that is raised here is the fact that huge amounts of federal money is supposed to go for health care, for millions more people who get subsidized, right?
Yeah. At the beginning of the health care debate, there was kind of a gentleman's agreement. There had been the hope that abortion would not be redebated during the health care debate, and there was going to be a maintenance of the status quo. And then, as you mentioned, the argument became of what is the status quo?
But let me ask before I bring Julie Rovner into this conversation, isn't health care itself one of the Catholic bishops' huge, long-standing, decades-old priorities?
Absolutely. I mean, before we were born, back in the 30s, the U.S. bishops were in favor of national health care. One of their priorities is that health care go to everyone, including undocumented workers, in other words, illegal aliens. They really want comprehensive and complete health care for everyone in the country, but they don't want it to pay for abortion.
Catholic bishops, of course, are just one group who lobby on this issue. And Julie Rovner, how intense has the fighting been over the precise language of how you word this health care bill on abortion?
It's been incredibly divisive. The intent going into this was that this bill be what's called abortion neutral, so that the Hyde Amendment, as you mentioned, which has banned federal funding for abortion since 1977, remain in place, so that there would be no direct federal funding of abortion.
This is even pro-choice lawmakers saying, look, we accept it, it's the way it is. We're not going to deal with it now.
That's right, because they didn't want it to get in the way of moving this bill forward. The real issue became what would happen to people who were using their own money to buy health insurance within these federally chartered exchanges, the new marketplaces, because many, if not most, private insurance does cover abortion. So now there's going to be federal subsidies for private health plans that cover abortion. So if you've got federal money flowing into these private health plans, were people going to suddenly lose a benefit that they already had? And that's where the big fight came. And in the House bill, originally there was a compromise, and then Bart Stupak,
leading pro-life member,
came in with an amendment and said no private plan that got any money, any of these subsidies, could offer abortion as a benefit.
But why has it been so difficult to agree on language, given that all lawmakers, even pro-choice lawmakers, have said, we don't want to change anything here? What makes this so hard?
Well, we haven't gotten to the Senate bill. In the Senate bill, there was a compromise negotiated by Barbara Boxer, leading pro-choice senator, and Ben Nelson, leading pro-life senator, that basically said that you could still have abortion covered, but you would have to write two checks, and abortion could be covered with that money. The pro-choice groups hate this idea, but the pro-life groups hate it even more. So here was a compromise that everybody, both sides, hate. Now the National Right to Life Committee says that any House member who votes for the Senate health bill is casting a career-defining pro-abortion vote. So when this Senate bill comes back to the House, the National Right to Life Committee says this is the most pro-abortion bill since Roe versus Wade.
Is this the most pro-abortion bill since Roe versus Wade, Father Rees?
I think the problem we have here is that, frankly, both sides are quite paranoid on the issue, and they don't trust each other. Nobody trusts anybody else's language. And frankly, we have a situation where the side that is most extreme, who says that they will bring down the entire health care bill on this issue, is probably the side that's going to win.
I think the father's absolutely right. People keep asking me, what does the language actually say? And there comes a point where it doesn't really matter what the language actually says. It only matters what the groups who keep score say that the language actually says.
Because these are groups that, for many voters, it's a shorthand. This candidate is approved, this candidate is unacceptable.
That's exactly precisely right. One of the big problems, though, is a procedural problem. at this point, the House must vote for the Senate bill with its language as is. There will be a second bill, this so-called fix-it bill, that has to go through the budget reconciliation process. There is precedent that you can't have abortion language in the budget reconciliation bill. So there might have to be a third bill. So actually getting to this is also a matter of trust, which, as we've pointed out, neither side has in the other one right now.
NPR's Julie Robner, sounds like lots more work for you.
Lots more work for me.
And Father Thomas Rees, thanks for coming by.
Thank you.